Welcome to Center Stage Minnesota. I am Charlie Volkerbeck. I'll be your host for this hour, this edition of Center Stage Minnesota, which is our program that focuses on the talents of Minnesota musicians. We take a look at things, try to filter through it a little bit, give you different perspectives of not just the music being put out, but what it's like to be a working musician in northern Minnesota, maybe get you out to see some live music, things like that. Center Stage Minnesota is an original series produced by Northern Community Radio and broadcast on the stations of the Ampers Network. Find us online at kaxe.org. Program support comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Coming up this week on Center Stage Minnesota, I've got a feature on one of my, I'm a bit nostalgic about this band, Arc Welder. They are a hard rock punk band from the existed from the late 80s until into the early 2000s. They're still together, but they are not nearly as active as they once were. And they're just a very important band, in my opinion, in the Minnesota music landscape, looking at a little somewhat history. And, you know, these guys have mostly got day jobs now and stuff like that, but they sure had a lot of fun with it and put out some great music. So we'll hear that feature interview coming up a little later. We're going to hear something shortly from Palitza, from their release from this year, a band that really has seen a lot of success in 2012. Right now we're going to go back to Drums and Guns from Lowe. and give you the Ghost, a very satisfying record from 2012 from Polizza, a band getting very popular this year. We just heard Fist Teeth Money from that release. Drums and Guns is a release from 2007 on Sub Pop Records by Low. And we started off the show with the song Hatchet from Low here on Center Stage Minnesota. I'm Charlie Polkerbeck. I'm your host for this hour of the program. And as you probably already know if you listen a lot, but maybe you don't, this is our show that focuses on the talents of Minnesota musicians. It's Northern Community Radio's effort to entertain, but even more than that, probably enhance the art scene in Minnesota, and that being, in this case, the music scene in Minnesota. I promised an Arc Welder interview with Rob Graber and Scott McDonald. I sat down with two of the three guys from Arc Welder. That's coming up shortly, and we'll hear a song from one of their records, early records, leading into that interview. Right now, I have got something from a band that in the City Pages newspaper magazine in this Twin Cities had a poll that had the top 20 bands from Minnesota ever. And for a band that really was sort of short-lived in Minnesota, they moved out to New York rather quickly, and they kind of got swallowed up in the machine that was the major label system in the mid-90s. Great music, though. They were a band that formed at McAllister College and named themselves after their psychology professor, which he wasn't real happy about. But maybe it made him feel a little better that they were a really good band. So to make the top 20 out of all the bands to come out of Minnesota, when you really didn't spend that much time here, and moved out to New York and ultimately didn't become hugely famous, which is one of the reasons we claim a lot of our artists. Walt Mink was fantastic. And from their debut release on Caroline Records in 1992, this is Twinkle and Shine from Miss Happiness.
We watched her run out of the war that she waged with herself, and we saw that she swayed with the weight of her father and brothers and boyfriends who bowed like a landfill and swallowed a smile at a gate. Till at 5 o'clock Sunday she burns them away. We shifted down into creep.
Stuck on AM off the record in Minneapolis. The first one, a double disc filled with tracks recorded at the studios of our sister station, Radio K. That's all mixed together from Arcwelder. It also appears on their disc, Xerxes. All right, I'm going to start with a little transparency. I am nostalgic about the Minneapolis band Arcwelder. Arcwelder is a three-piece band that probably fits best into the punk rock category, but there are pop elements mixed in as well. They are far from the most noisy or aggressive band in Minnesota's music history, though. Starting with the Suicide Commandos and a little later by the Replacements and Husker Du and many other inventive and musically notable bands, too many to mention here, the Twin Cities music scene has rested on a foundation of loud music, most of it being some variation of punk rock. In those competitive conditions, I consider Arcwelder an important and standout band. In most of their active years, Bill Graber, guitar, bass, and vocals, Bill's brother Rob Graber, bass and guitar, and Scott McDonald, drums and vocals, put out a highly respectable body of work, and I venture to guess that it's highly unlikely that anyone has ever left an Arcwelder show feeling cheated. A cease and desist order in 1988 forced them to change from their first name, Tilt-A-Whirl, to Arcwelder. Which name suits the music put out by these three guys over the years, I'm not sure. You can make that call. This is Charlie Polkerbeck. Here's the conversation I recently had with Scott McDonald and Rob Graber of Arcwelder.
All right, well, first question I have for you guys is, why do you guys think so many great bands are three-piece bands? I've kind of come to realize that most of my favorite bands fall in that category. What is it about three pieces that, is there anything special that you guys have noticed that from being in one?
I don't know. There's a couple things about them I like. I think there's a little more room, a little more space. You don't feel obligated to put that fourth part in or fifth part in and cover things up. I mean, we've always been of the philosophy that it's like simple parts and it's the combination of the parts that makes it interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think if you can hear all the individual parts better, for me, that makes it more interesting. Now, I mean, there's lots of great bands that are four pieces and more.
Yeah.
But
do you have any opinion about that?
I don't know if I do, but I wonder if the being a three piece means you're not incorporating some fourth person into it who's the singer. It seems like a lot of bands congeal around the music first, and then they add Eddie Vedder, who was singing great over these demos they made.
Yeah, but that one worked, right? I mean, it's like The Who. I like The Who, and they're basically three musicians and, well, four musicians, but three people playing and a singer. You know? I don't know.
I'm just curious. It's just a pattern that I've picked out as far as what I've turned into like over the years, especially on the heavier side of things. The name of your band is spelled out in one of the silver stars on the exterior of First Avenue. What does that mean to you guys to have them choose you for one of those?
Oh, it's great.
That's
really
cool.
You know, really happy about it.
I mean, I suspect they did it by who played there the most. And back in the day, we played there, you know, twice a month for years.
Well, that would be why Rifle Sport has the one
over
the
door, because they played there the most, apparently.
Over the door,
and we played there like half of their shows after we became a band. I mean, we just played, you know, and so I think that's largely the reason. But yeah, it's cool. It's great. It's an honor. No question.
And we set some attendance records there, too, when...
Oh, did we?
Yeah, Kennedy wasn't cutting people off like
Yeah. Ixnay.
400 and...
Oh, no, we had over something. 500 in there one set. For a while, we were popular. What the hell?
You know, there's a lot of big names up there.
There's a local pride part, too, on the part of First Avenue, I think. I mean, there's bands that you probably haven't heard of that were up there, like mm-hmm. Neglectors, or I can't think of who else. Maybe even L7-3 was up there.
Yeah. But yeah, to your point, it really is cool.
Yeah.
I mean, that's you know, it's in some sense, it's validation that people liked what we did, and that's cool. I mean,
yeah, because people I, you know, I've worked with see and go, do you know you have a star on First
Avenue? We do?
What kind of dynamics, the unique dynamics are created by having two brothers in a three-piece band.
I don't know. I've never been in a band without my brother. Really. Never been in a band that played much without my brother. Or Scott. Never with neither. I guess that's not quite true. I was in a couple, but never anything very popular. I think in some sense, Bill and I get along so well that it makes it easier. I mean, I could see bands, you know, there's famous examples like, say, Oasis, where they fight all the time. Mm-hmm. Right? And we've never really had that issue at all. And so I think it makes it easier for us. We share a lot of the same values. We don't have different ideas of what we should be doing around the music, you know, like lifestyle things and things like that. We've never had any of that kind of tension because, I mean, I've known Bill since he was born, right? So for me, it's just completely natural.
But then why aren't you the brothers that fight like Oasis?
Because I'm so clearly better than Bill that it's never been an issue. He's just learned to accept his place. And no, I have no idea. It's not our nature. We've never, I mean, even as kids, we didn't really, you know, fight much. And so for whatever reason, I think that makes it work really well for us to be in a band. And of course, now we're too old and tired to fight anyway, so it's not going to happen. But
you and your brothers switch the bass and guitar at various points during your shows. Is there a pattern to what? Is it related to who wrote those songs?
Yeah, it is. Typically, and that's why the preponderance of the songs, the early songs I played guitar on, because I'd played guitar longer, and so Bill picked up the bass. And then, like within a year maybe, he got significantly better on guitar than I was, and so it switched radically then. And so most of the newer stuff I'm playing bass on. Scott will sometimes have me play guitar on a song he wrote, but mostly it's who wrote the song plays guitar.
How do the writing go with you guys? Is it everybody contributes or?
Pretty much, there's layers to it. It usually starts out as a, do you want to answer?
No, you're doing so well.
I can take a shot at this.
It's sort of in thirds, but not quite. Like Bill writes a third, I write a third, the band writes a third. As a collaboration, but it's heavier to Bill. It's not. It's more. Bill does more than a third.
Yeah, I think so. But I don't sing and I don't write the lyrics. So that, you know, that's what typically the way a song will get written is we'll be at the start of a practice. We'll just start jamming, just start making noise, just to make noise, and something interesting might happen, and that's being recorded. And then Bill or Scott will take those tapes and listen and sift back through them and say, "Hey, that's a cool riff. Let's work on that."
And organize it.
Say, put this part with this part and play that and do, you know, and then come back, you know, a month later or whatever with some next step in that song. And we'll jam on it and try out different things as a band. And then one of them will take it and write a melody and lyrics.
How about what'd you call it that for?
Yeah, that was a band written song. Okay. Definitely. I think a lot of them were written, like I said. Some of them will come, Bill would come with a whole idea of your own. Free Me was something you just wrote, right?
Right.
Yeah. And it just came as a song presented to the band. And I mean, we refined it based on how we could play it and what, you know, little tweaks to it. But basically that song was done when Scott brought it. Plastic was that way. Bill just brought that as a complete song
right,
to the band. You know, it gets modified subtly by the way Scott plays the drum part or whatever. But those are basically done. But most of the more recent ones have all been based on band collaboration.
It seemed like Touch and Go Records is a very comfortable label to be on.
Awesome label to be on.
The quality of your experience during the sort of exciting and also tumultuous 90s seemed at least partially tied to sort of a lack of negativity on the front, the side, you know, where...
I mean, from the label.
The business side of things. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it was the perfect label for us to be on because we weren't... Go ahead, Scott.
Well, meaning that it freed us up or the lack of pressure from the label?
Well, that and the ability to enjoy the experience because there's not as much...
Certainly. You know, there's not any of the flotsam that comes with being on a label. With Touch and Go, they like give you half the profits and then they kind of stay out of your way. They kind of guide you along a little, like...
Right.
They'll give you little guidelines as far as, I don't know, publicity or this or that. But as far as the music goes, you're completely free to do what you want.
I mean, they were all about the music and all about supporting the bands and less about the business side, which for us was perfect.
Well,
we dissuaded interest from other labels at one point because we didn't want, you know, the music, it wasn't going to be our careers in our life. Mm-hmm. And so why would we... in some sense, make it mean less by having to do what someone else said. So what someone else wanted our band to be. if we signed to a different label, that would have happened. With Touch and Go, there was none of that. They were very supportive of exactly what we wanted to do on our terms. Corey's the nicest guy in the world, absolute prince of a man, to, you know, supported everything we wanted to do, said how much he liked our music, and we put out four records on his label with, you know, marginal sales. I mean, we sold records, don't get me wrong, but we weren't, you know, we weren't making him a lot of money or anything, and he supported us the whole time, and I mean, it's just, couldn't be a better label to be on.
So you guys actually, some doors did maybe open into that major label realm, and you kind of made the decision, well, I would guess it come down to keeping an eye on creative integrity, then it was what you were more concerned about.
I think that's exactly it. Yeah. I mean, it was never, we were a little older when we started the band, and we never had this, you know, toppermost of the poppermost, we're going to be big stars kind of attitude. We really loved the music, and when the time came to answer those questions, I think we could clearly see that we would be giving up part of what we really loved about being in the band in order to get this next level of publicity. And it just wasn't worth it.
Well, and we wanted to be on Touch and Go.
Absolutely.
From the beginning.
They hit that sweet spot for us about being about the music, you know, not about how many units you can move or whatever.
But as I remember, Corey wasn't that interested in us till he saw us live.
Right.
Flower took us on tour with him, and Corey thought he was coming down to see Bricklayer Cake, and that we were going on first, and Bricklayer Cake went on first, and we played in the middle, and that's how Corey saw us.
Okay, yeah.
But he'd been hearing a lot of buzz from people in Minneapolis, friends of his, about us, but he wasn't convinced until he saw us live.
Yeah.
And that almost happened by an accident. That's interesting.
An awful lot of the good things that have happened to us in the band are as a result of the guys in Rifle Sport and Shellac. There's overlap there, obviously, and those guys have been really good to us all along. You know, we met Corey and went through Chicago because Flower, the bass player for Rifle Sport, took us out on tour with him.
And Flower was on Touch and Go.
Flower was on Touch and Go.
And so was Bricklayer Cake.
Yeah, and Todd Trainer, Bricklayer Cake, the drummer for Shellac, has been really supportive of us over the years and had us play shows with them and taken us on tour with them. And I mean, so between those, whatever it is, seven or eight guys and Corey, and of course, a lot of people here in town, a lot of the good things that happened to us were because of that connection or those guys. Gonna do myself a favor.
You just heard Favor from Arc Welder's 1989 release, Jacket Made in Canada, here on Center Stage, Minnesota.
You bring up Todd Trainer. I'd like to have you, a number of people, I don't know if it's widely accepted or not. I never saw him, but he's remarked as maybe the best drummer to come out of Minneapolis. He was in Rifle Sport and now he's in Shellac, and he probably is in other projects. He's kind of a ghost a little bit in the history. Unless you dig really deep, maybe you can help alleviate that. Give me a little synopsis of him.
Well, the Rifle Sport, when their drummer Jimmy left, they were looking for another drummer. And, well, I think Gerard left at the same time. They're looking for a drummer and a guitar player. Okay, but I remember Chris Johnson telling me, we found this new drummer. And, who is this guy? He's kind of a new guy. No one knows anything about him. So he kind of first started drumming with Rifle Sport. I don't know if he had that much experience before then.
Incredibly entertaining drummer to watch. I mean, best or whatever, that's subjective, right? That's aesthetics or whatever and what you like. But very interesting drummer and really fun to watch play drums.
He's a superstar.
Yes, he really is. If you've ever seen a Shellac show, he is the show. They put him up front because he is the show. I mean, Steve and Bob answer questions and do all that thing, but when they're playing... You're watching Todd. I mean, that's not quite true. I'm exaggerating a little, but he is really, really an entertaining drummer. Having said that, there's a lot of great drummers that have come out of Minneapolis.
Yeah. I mean, that's obviously very high praise in order to
He's definitely in the discussion. There's no question about that, but there's a lot of great drummers that have come out of Minneapolis. Present company included, perhaps.
I would agree. I was at the show at the 400 Bar, in which there was a bomb threat called in, which promptly ended what, to me, looked like it was going to be one of the best shows I witnessed from you guys, and that's saying a lot. Was there more to that story? Is it deeper, or is that pretty much the end of it?
Well, we had played in Chicago the night before, hadn't played as well as we had hoped to, so we were, ready to kill it in Minneapolis, and I think we came out smoking. What I heard about the bomb threat is actually a friend of ours had... There was some guy who kept hitting on her and she kept turning him down, and he got mad and went to the phone booth outside and called in, which no one knew at the time, called in a bomb threat. And the person working at the 400 Bar who was in charge wasn't the normal person and wasn't used to, I don't know how far I should go into this. I've heard that there were other people going, oh, our bar gets bomb threats all the time, and we don't shut down.
So I didn't know, we were on stage, right? All I remember is that they said, there's a problem with the electricity. Everybody needs to leave. And everybody did. I was just stunned by that. Because it was such an obvious lie.
Yeah.
But yeah. And of course, then it becomes the best show we were ever going to play, right? Because we didn't really play. We played like three songs.
It's kind of the one that got away in my mind. But right? It's going to be this great show.
But it's only because we didn't play it. Right? I mean, if we played it, it would have just been another show. But since it got canceled, it's like, oh, that was the best ever!
Well, it's definitely headed in the right direction. Yeah. Right? So, some of your fans are pretty exceedingly accomplished people. Of those that have proclaimed themselves fans of Arc Welder, who's the most flattering to get their admiration?
John Peel played our single. John Peel, what was his show in England?
Yeah.
The John Peel show, yeah. I guess. But
we were on the Nifty 50 end of the year.
That's pretty cool. I have some sort of memory of maybe there was a blindfold...
You should have done this interview 15 years ago. Yeah. We would have known the answers to these questions.
Well, who's the bass player from Gang of Four? Dave King, Gill.
King.
King?
Oh, I don't know.
Anyway.
Sarah Lee.
Yes, the male bass player. They had him do a blindfold test of all these singles that were out, and our single For Favor came out in Britain. I think he liked ours based on he hated all the other ones. Well, the at least this, when he heard our quality, he said, well, at least this isn't that last one. Oh. That's all I remember.
I don't know. I haven't heard a lot of people... What names do you have of people who say they're...
Well, obviously, Steve Albini's a fan.
All of Shellac, of course, it's great to have Bob and Steve and Todd all be fans.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then it's usually people who are putting Arc Welder posters in the backgrounds of movies or something.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. It's in My cousin.
Well, it's no.
It was a Pesci movie we were in.
Yeah. There's a poster in the Law and Order episode.
Yep.
It's a poster in, what was the one with Glenn Close? The Safety of Objects.
Objects, yeah.
And what was the Pesci movie?
I forget.
I can usually remember, but yeah.
Ask Mr. Google.
Do you ever think about Arc Welder's importance in the landscape of Minnesota music?
No. I mean, we've had longevity. People still seem to, you know, seem to still like the songs, even, mm-hmm. you know, 15 years later. And that's cool. I really appreciate that. I don't know.
It's nice to be appreciated. It's hard to know how much influence we've directly had when there's
so much
70 other bands that could have also influenced whatever band. Part of a stream.
Yeah, and the idea that there's a Minnesota music landscape. I mean, there are bands, right? There are bands from here that play. You influence each other. I get that. There's sort of a tradition. I don't feel like we've, you know, directed the Minneapolis music scene in any way. We were part of it.
But I was curious if you, I get that. I think that, you know, I always wonder sometimes if people that are in bands such as yours ever take much time to think about that. So a lot of times the answer is no, you know, it's humble that they don't. But
It's sort of we have to be told. It's not that we think about it that much and then someone will tell me how much it meant to them and, you know, super cool.
Yeah, no, that's really gratifying when someone will say, you know, that song really had a positive effect on me at some point in my life, or that kind of stuff is really cool on an individual level. And I've heard that occasionally. But as far as this larger arc of some progression of a music scene where it started with the Trash Minute, it may be there, but I don't feel it, that we were, you know.
You know, my own take on it is that if there is no scene to build on, I mean, they're talking about this second golden age right now, and, you know, there's bricks and mortar. I thought you guys were one of the bricks, you know, in terms of providing something to build on and being a band that was sort of a workhorse band in the town that put out good stuff and played great shows on a regular basis. And you guys had your own sound, really kind of, you guys successfully, maybe not setting out to do that, but created your own sound, where there was one band that named Voodoo Velovement that I liked quite a bit. And they had one song that all their fans called the Arc Welder song, because it was and they were big fans of yours, but, you know, and it was a bit derivative, and it's like it was just interesting that I thought it was cool that you guys had established your own sound that nobody else could really step into that without being immediately associated with you. I thought that was interesting. So
kind of ironic, because people spent most of the time telling us how much we sounded like other people.
Well, maybe that's just part of the big cycle, right?
Yeah.
Okay, now this band sounds like us, and other people say we sound like this band.
Yeah.
Who would you consider some of the, you know, if you had to name one or two or three, the most underappreciated bands that have been in Minnesota in maybe the last 20 years or something like that?
Wow. See, that's a dangerous question to ask, because we'll miss somebody and then it'll...
It's true, but the Baby Astronauts...
That was more like 25 years ago, but still.
Jonestown.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of...
Yeah, Rob Williams should have been a rock star, I think.
Yeah, he had a fantastic voice.
Just amazing pop sense.
Who?
Rob Williams, who was the guitar player for the Baby Astronauts. When I listen to his stuff, he's just... It's just really good pop sense. Hook-laden songs, great voice, really... Great little pop songs, you know.
But in the rock vein.
Yeah, well, rock. Yeah, they weren't, you know, it was guitar pop. You know, and they were around for 3, 4, 5 years and put out a record, and that was that.
They put out a lot of cassettes before they put out the record. And
then he was in a band after that called...
Ground Loop,
which I liked. But that was 20 years ago, I suppose.
Probably.
What club is your favorite club to play live in town?
Well, it's kind of a tie between the Turf Club and 7th Street Entry.
I would say historically the 7th Street Entry is where we're the most comfortable playing. I mean, that's where we cut our teeth. We played the Entry probably more than 100 times, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the stage we're the most comfortable at, the club we're the most comfortable being at. Historically, First Avenue was an amazingly well-run place compared to the places you'd go around the country. You'd come to First Ave, you'd get treated just great. The equipment was good. The people there knew what they were doing. in the over the last 5 years, we've kind of split our playing between the Turf Club and First Ave, but historically it was the entry.
Well, now I've looked at old calendars, like from 81 or 82 or whatever. Oh, I was there every night some weeks.
Yeah, the bands that came through there, oh man. In the mid-80s, the bands that came through the entry, phenomenal. Go back, they have them, some people are posting them online, the monthly calendars from 85 or whatever, and it's like a an all-star lineup. Every weekend there were just great bands playing.
I don't know if you have much to say about it or not, but you're welcome to if you want to. I was going to have you guys tell me about this All Tomorrow's Parties gig that you have over in England coming up, and what, November 30th?
It's a weekend.
Oh, okay.
Starting the 30th, but yeah. Well, Shellac invited us. They're curating the weekend. They've invited us twice before in 2002 and 2004, although 2004 was split between a series of bands. It's a lot of fun. What do you want to say about it, Rob?
Well, are you familiar with what the way it works? Barry Hogan started this festival maybe 11 years ago now. And I think they've moved in the intervening years, but now they're back where they started. They found a holiday camp, which is sort of a resort with semi-furnished apartments. It looks like Motel 6s, just row after row of these sort of little semi-furnished Soviet-era apartment blocks. And he got them in the off-season. He's able to rent the whole place. And so there's probably, 300 rooms or more in this holiday camp, right on the English Channel, south by Rye, England. And then there's a rec center or whatever where they have a stage. And so what he does is he hires a band to curate and invite 30 of their friends or 30 bands that they like or whatever to come play a festival at this place. And the fans rent rooms for the weekend in this place. And then they can see all the bands and kind of hang out at this holiday camp for the weekend.
So the difference is it's curated by a band versus what bands can you get at the time.
Right.
Well, there's a little of that, but it's a lot.
So it ends up being sort of, here's bands Shellac likes. Here's bands Matt Groening likes, because he did one, right? Or here's bands that Sonic Youth likes. Or
The National, or...
Yeah, so it gives it a certain slant based on the band that he chooses to curate. And they've expanded. They do lots of events now. And this one's called The Nightmare Before Christmas, and it's the first weekend, the last weekend of November, first weekend of December.
Thanks a lot to Scott and Rob for being so gracious with their time and joining me here on Center Stage, Minnesota. From a record simply titled Pull from Arc Welder, this is the song Truth.
Oh,
Arc Welder. One of my favorite bands from the 90s. I saw them, I don't know how many times. One of the interesting components about that band was their live shows were just unmistakably, reliably good. And that's one of the reasons I think they're so important to that scene. It's as important as the music that they put out because they just set a standard. I mean, when people are regularly putting on shows like that in a town and you're a band in that town, you constantly have an example of what it takes to be considered good in that town. All right, well, we've got one coming here from a release called The Curse of the Selby Tigers. And from the Selby Tigers, this is Super Breakout.
He's a mean bottle rocket, no way to stop it. Friends know better than to comment. Come on, we need to break out. We all just want to get out. Regular at the liquor store. Every night he's passed out on the floor. Crashing parties, so confused. Bar hop in, tell refuse. Worked all day, no, wasn't that clever. She's so tired, why don't you sleep better? Come on, we need to break out. We all just wanna get out. A nice new way to stand tall. Slaving away, nobody notice at all. She's burnt out like a match. Tired little dog playing fast. Series of problems. Our friends are there to help us solve them. Come on, help them to break out. We all just want to help out.
Whoa. I meant to play a song by a band King Can there, but this Stuck on AM double CD, that's a CD that is a bunch of live recordings that were recorded at Radio K on the U of M in Minneapolis, one of our sister stations, is mislabeled, and I realized, and I knew that, but I forgot it. That was Swallowed by Hammerhead. Maybe we'll get King Cannon in a future show. Before that, we heard from the Selby Tigers, The Curse of the Selby Tigers, a song less than 2 minutes long, super breakout. And we are going to go out tonight on Center Stage Minnesota with some music from Happy Apple. But first, I'd like to remind you that Center Stage Minnesota is an original series produced by Northern Community Radio and broadcast on the stations of the Ampers Network. Find us online at kaxe.org. Program support comes from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. It's been a pretty raucous show. We're going to get taken out by some, well, it's kind of raucous in attitude, but it is free jazz from the band Happy Apple. I recently got to talk to Dave King of The Bad Plus and of Happy Apple, and you can look for that conversation coming up on a future episode of Center Stage Minnesota. But taking us out tonight from their release, Please Refrain from Fronting, This Is the Invasion Has Become. Thank you.